This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. This is hour number two of our show. And in this hour, we'll be talking about Syria. Back in February, a former Lebanese prime minister, a man named Rafik Hariri, was killed by a car bomb in Beirut. Almost immediately, there were people who said they believed that Syria might well be involved. And in fact, a recent report commissioned by the United Nations on the assassination has indeed implicated Syria, or at least has implicated some high-level government officials in Syria, although the government of Syria has also officially denied any role in the bombing. Syria has been facing some increasing criticism. It was criticized for its involvement in Lebanon, for its involvement in Iraq, and there are some growing demands for political change from within, some dissatisfaction with the current government. We'll try and talk about all of these things this morning in this part of Focus 580 as we talk with Dr. Najib Ghadban. He is a professor of political science and also Middle East studies at the University of Arkansas. And among his interests are Islamic movements and Syrian politics and generally politics of the Arab world. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if you're listening around Illinois or Indiana, or in fact, you could be listening on the internet. As long as you're in the United States, you could use the toll-free line also. That is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Ghadban, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just before, I certainly want to talk about the Melis report and about the Hariri assassination. But first, I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the current president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. He took over in 2000 when his father, Hafez al-Assad, died. And this was something of an accidental presidency in the sense that Hafez had been grooming another of his sons to take over. And that man, Basil, was killed in a car accident. So that is how Bashar ended up being the next in line. And by all accounts, he was somebody who had never been particularly interested in politics and didn't have a lot of political ambition. Having said all that, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how well he's done as president, Bashar al-Assad.
Well, I think when he first came to power, you know, he gave an inauguration speech in which he talked about reform, talked about a new era for Syria, and kind of that's raised expectations inside Syria, which led eventually to really some kind of an opening up in the country. Intellectuals formed various civil society movements and groups. They launched a movement which was known civil society movement, and they began to debate real, you know, kind of issues. But unfortunately, about 9 months after that, he decided to crack down on that movement using international and regional pressures, you know, the Intifada and the occupied territories, the rise of Sharon to power, and then came 9/11. So he used that to say, well, you know, we have to postpone all of these liberalizing measures and focus on, you know, kind of coping with the international pressure. So since then, he really hasn't done much in terms of reforming the political system, or improving the performance of the Syrian economy. So it's been kind of, you know, more disappointment for the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Specifically then going to the death of Mr. Hariri. As I said, I think that when he died back in February, there was a lot of speculation right away. People were saying, well, we think that Syria might be connected to this. There was a UN UN Commissioner report. It was overseen by this a German judge, Mr. Melis, and just recently, fairly recently, the report came out. The major conclusions the report said, and it's not really clear to me how directly it implicated Syria. It did, in one of the phrases, said that that the assassination could not have happened without the approval of top-ranking Syrian security officials. And I think that it has fairly specifically implicated both the president's brother-in-law and the president's brother, saying that they were somehow involved. Although, as I say, it's not real clear to me how directly it has said Syria was involved. I'm sure that you've looked at this closely. What's important about the Melis report?
I think what's important about it is the fact that there had been several political assassinations in Lebanon over the last 20 years or so. Syria went to Lebanon in 1975, 76, and kind of really played, at certain point, stabilizing role in Lebanon. But toward the end, after 2000, when Israel withdrew from South Lebanon, we've seen kind of mounting pressure on Syria to withdraw. And I was one of those who felt Syria should have, withdrawn back then. Syrian presence in Lebanon became a source of resentment for most Lebanese, especially those in the Christian camp. And I think one reason behind the resentment was the interference of the security officials, of Syrian security officials in Lebanon, in the details of both the political and economic lives of Lebanon. So there were a lot of complaints about that over the last few years. And while Mr. Hariri actually served as a prime minister under the Syrian kind of, presence in Lebanon, toward the end, he became kind of more feeling unease toward the Syrian role in Lebanon. And all of that came to a turning point when the term of the current president came to an end. This is actually last year, toward like September 2004. And the Syrian government, Syrian leadership, decided to renew Lahoud, the president's term, despite widespread opposition to that, including among Mr. Hariri. So that was, I think, really the beginning of serious trouble in Lebanon, serious trouble. By insisting on renewing to Lahoud, he kind of really antagonized most Lebanese politicians, and that required amending the constitution. And I think everybody knew it was a terrible mistake on the part of the Syrian leadership, because they didn't have to do this. They had other friends who could have, promoted for the position. So Hariri, after that point, turned more into the opposition to Syria. And that's, when the crime happened, people started to look into motives. I mean, who really had motives to kill Hariri? And honestly, when Hariri was assassinated, for the first 2-3 days, I couldn't believe that Syria would be involved. I mean, it didn't make much sense. But if we look, examine the Syrian regime, and you mentioned, the president's brother and his brother-in-law, these two guys, one of them controls the Republican Guard, that's his brother, and his brother-in-law controls the security forces. So it's kind of really like a family business, This reminds us of how Iraq was run under Saddam in a way. And so, one theory actually goes that, maybe these two guys planned the assassination without, even informing Bashar, who, as you said, he's really a man who became president by accident. I mean, he was not groomed for this task, but, after his brother was killed in a car accident, he was kind of pushed into that responsibility. So it's kind of, reading the Melis report carefully, it makes sense that, an act like this, a huge operation like the assassination of Hariri, which, by the way, killed 22 other individuals, could have not happened without the knowledge of the Syrian security agencies, who were controlling, the details of what goes on in Lebanon. Now, the question, you know, the big question, whether Bashar really had a kind of prior knowledge about this or not. But there are a lot of circumstantial evidence connecting the six security officials, including his brother and brother-in-law, to at least certain phases of the planning to this assassination.
Well, you know, certainly in Lebanon there has been, maybe not quite so recently, but there has been, not in the too distant past, a history of factions that are struggling with one another for power using violence against one another. So I suppose if indeed the Syrians were involved in a direct way, I suppose they could have said, well, people won't suspect us, Syria. They'll think, well, this is just an internal Lebanese power struggle. Certainly Mr. Hariri, and I'm sure he had enemies in Lebanon, but you still also wonder why it is that if indeed the Syrians were involved, why they would do something so dramatic that would get so much attention, and would not they be worried that somehow that would reflect back on them?
That's really the question which faced many of us. I mean, you know, it didn't make much sense politically to do that. Mm. And, you know, they had other means maybe to deal with the opposition of Hariri. But I think, again, Syria was involved in, again, maybe directly or indirectly in the past, in the assassination of other, you know, Lebanese politicians. But to me, what you said was exactly accurate, that, you know, factions, in fact, were involved in maybe carrying out these kind of acts of political violence and sometimes assassinations. The point, I think, again, goes to show that sometimes those people in the security apparatus could be so arrogant that they think they could get away with it. And I think this is maybe the miscalculation in this case. I mean, Hariri, unlike any other politician in Lebanon, had an international status. I mean, he was, you know, maybe the biggest figure that Lebanon produced in the last three decades. And, I mean, he was bigger than Bashar himself. I mean, he was well-connected, had excellent relations with the U.S., with France, with Saudi Arabia, with everybody. And so, you know, I think it was not it's not a usual kind of, you know, political assassination, which, I mean, there was a prior political attempt on the life of a minister who was opposed to Syria, and he survived. And, you know, there was no international cry to that assassination or attempt, you know. And that person, you know, immediately accused Syria of being behind the assassination. But Hariri, I think, because of his, you know, connections, because of his status, I think, you know, generated that international kind of interest. And you know, again, there were really certain events which led to this. When Syria insisted on renewing Tilahud, the international community, the United Nations, passed Resolution 1559, which actually required that Syria should not intervene in the domestic affairs of Lebanon, required Syria to withdraw from Lebanon. And in a way, Syria blamed Hariri for the passage of that resolution. So, you know, that you have here more of a kind of motive to maybe try to get rid of Hariri. And it could be, I mean, I'm not, you know, we don't really know exactly. It could be that someone in these security agencies in Damascus decided to do this, and they thought they simply could get away with it, you know. And, you know, there would be condemnation, there would be, and then things would go back to normalcy. But that didn't happen. And, you know, there are certain things which, you know, made me, again, believe that definitely someone in Damascus had something to do with this. The immediate reaction of Syria to the assassination was very kind of, you know, suspicious. Like, you know, when the Lebanese politicians were calling for an international investigation, you know, Syrians saying, no, you don't need that. Lebanon could handle that. Everybody knew that Lebanon, under the Syrian protection, could not really have done that. And then there were efforts on the part of some Lebanese security officials to kind of tamper with the evidence. And I think that's what led to the arrest eventually of four security officials in Lebanon. Those are very close to Syria. And again, I don't think that the Milis Commission, you know, would have done that without strong evidence to at least connecting these individuals to some aspect of the operation. Again, Syria might had a role just in terms of planning, not necessarily execution of this. And again, reading the report, which has a lot of details about that, I mean, makes a good case. But again, we're still talking about those people are innocent, till proven guilty. I think the next step right now is for these individuals to be interviewed by the Millis Commission outside Syria. This is, I think, one of the sticking issues right now between Syria and the Commission. When Millis interviewed them in Damascus, he was not happy with that because they were kind of, coached to what to say, and they were, they taped the interviews. And so Millis felt that, that was not done properly. So I think now after the passage of Security Council 1636, the Millis has now, the backing of the international community to request that these individuals would be kind of investigated outside Syria. And that's what's going to happen, I think.
Yeah, so you think even though here we're talking, obviously the president, Bashar al-Assad, has first and foremost, he said Syria didn't have anything to do with the assassination.
Right.
And, but then he did say that Syria would cooperate with the investigation. But here now we are again just to remind people, we're talking about this man's brother and brother-in-law who are part of this very small, very tight ruling circle in the country. And that it seemed that would be for the man to give up his brother and his brother-in-law. That's even if we're just simply talking about having them participate in interviews, that seemed that's a lot.
Yes. I think Bashar faces, maybe the most serious challenge to his presidency. If he decides to hand over these two individuals to the international commission, and then if they were found, somehow implicated, he's in trouble because these are the two most powerful individuals in Bashar's kind of political power base. And if he doesn't, he's in trouble. So, really there's no easy way out of this. And I'm just now reading some of the actually excerpts of his speech, which he gave this morning. Our time, but it's kind of evening time in Damascus. And he seems to be kind of, saying, yeah, we will cooperate, but on our terms. And he's showing more defiance. Saying he would not be the one to allow international pressure to determine how things should be run in his country. So it seems to me that, again, there's really no easy way out of this for him.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Najib Ghadban. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and Middle East Studies at the University of Arkansas and is interested in political currents in the Arab world and Islamic movements and specifically in Syrian politics. And we're talking this morning about Syria. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And we have someone to talk with here on our toll-free line, a caller in Chicago. Hello.
Oh, good morning. I get the impression that many people in Lebanon believed more strongly that the United States or Israel were involved in the attack more so than Syria. And my question is sort of like two parts. When you say that it's challenged his presidency, the impression I have is that the Syrians are very strongly in back of him, so that the challenge would be outside, not so much inside. And the second part of my question is this German judge who is heading the report that the West is putting so much, giving so much credence to, didn't he do that failed study of the bombing of the German nightclub, and he turned out to be wrong, or his investigation was very seriously flawed? I mean, my impression was that this man has a poor track record. So are we in the West putting too much credence in a rather tentative report?
Well, I think, you know, regarding the second question, I really haven't heard of this story that, you know, he had this background. I'm not talking about Mr. Mills.
Yeah.
But what I know, we're talking about an international team made up of about more than 70 individuals from 20 countries. So I think it's not just Mr. Mills, to my knowledge. And from what I know, they've done serious investigation so far. I mean, you know, they interviewed over 300 individuals, read about 4,000 documents. And I think they've been, they made a breakthrough, to my knowledge, in the investigation. Once they were able to, look into the bank accounts of the security officials in Lebanon, those four who were arrested, and were able to listen to some of the phone calls using a cellular network that was controlled by a close person to these four individuals. So the point that I'm suggesting here, and I understand when people are, you know, kind of suspicious sometimes of these kind of investigations, and unfortunately, because, I mean, looking into the Iraq case and the whole questions of weapons of mass destruction and how intelligence was manipulated, I mean, people have the right to be suspicious of that. But actually, in this case, so far I see, I mean, the commission has conducted itself, you know, more professionally. Now, I heard that some people, you know, are saying, you know, this is, you know, Mr. Mills has some, you know, political motives and all of that. But at least in Lebanon, to my knowledge, nobody really, maybe some people, but most people have not questioned his integrity. As far as your first, you know, the first part of the question, that the pressure on the Syrian regime is coming from outside, that's true. But there's actually mounting pressure from within Syria. The economic conditions in Syria are extremely difficult. People in Syria are just, you know, in a mood. They're awaiting to see what's going to happen to them. They don't want, I mean, the general feeling, they don't want to be punished for something that some of their security officials or maybe political officials had done. And, I could tell you that, in fact, I like to talk about this, about some of the, you know, latest political attempts from inside Syria to pressure the government to open up, to really be more accountable, to make sure, again, that there will be no international sanctions on the country, which would be devastating for the people of Syria.
At the same time, though, the Syrians, I know, are very proud people, and I don't think they, just as much as the Iraqis, want things imposed on them from the outside. So as much as there might be a desire for change, it seems to me that pressure from the outside, especially when it comes very heavy-handed and without a willingness to honestly negotiate, seems to me it might solidify the Syrian people.
It might, to a point. I think people inside Syria were disappointed with their government, and especially this last summer. There were a lot of hopes that during the Ba'ath Party convention, which took place actually this last June, that Bashar would take certain steps to open up the country, to consolidate the domestic front, to, you know, and this is one way to cope with international pressure. There were certain demands to release political prisoners, to lift emergency laws in effect since 1963, to basically change, amend the constitution to allow the formation of political parties. These were the basic demands of most Syrian opposition groups, inside and outside. Mm-hmm. And the regime actually failed to take any measure. I mean, they mentioned one thing. They said, we're going to look into relaxing the implementation of the emergency laws. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if people inside Syria now, I think they're, you know, they have a mixed feelings. From one hand, you know, as you said, you're correct in saying that really they don't want the international community to come and, you know, tell them how to run their own, you know, affairs. On the other hand, some of them do see an opportunity maybe to maybe kind of, you know, put the pressure on the regime to a point where finally they would realize, hey, you know, our strength is in opening up the country, in having democratic system, in having accountable government, in, you know, widening political participation among its citizens. But unfortunately, Bashar has not really proved to be that kind of reformer that people thought he would be when he came first to power in 2000. So, And in fact, I have one specific, you know, example, which I'd like to talk about maybe a little later, about, you know, someone who came from Syria. Maybe I should mention it now. A friend of mine, a political activist, his name is Kemal Labwani, and he was active in the early days of the Damascus Spring in 2000-2001. And again, you know, his main kind of demands were political opening, freedom of expression, lifting emergency laws. And he was imprisoned for 3 years because of that. His colleagues are still in prison. They are the 10 leaders of the so-called Damascus Spring movement. Kemal was released, and he continued his activism. He was invited to Europe and to the United States. He was invited to Europe by Amnesty International, and then he was invited here by the State Department. And he spent the last about 2 months basically trying to gain support for the domestic opposition to initiate, you know, democratic change inside Syria, and to tell the international community we don't want the people of Syria to be punished, penalized because of the actions of their government. He went back to Syria actually on Monday. He arrived on Tuesday. He was arrested upon his arrival. And those of us who are, you know him, we've been very kind of active with the media trying to launch a campaign for his immediate release. So this is someone from inside who doesn't want, again, you know, anyone to come and take over his country. He's opposed totally to an invasion by any country, but he wants serious reform from within Syria, peaceful, democratic reform. And there's still no tolerance for these kind of, you know, activities. So, again, I mean, that's really tells me that Bashar maybe is not the person, you know, to do that.
May I ask one more question?
Sure.
How much stomach do you think the international community has for putting any type of pressure beyond verbal and perhaps threats on Syria? Because I'm thinking now, I think most people are dismayed with Iraq, so I think I can't see the international community joining for an armed intervention. And at the same time, I would think countries like France, given the problem that it's having right now, might also hesitate to inflame further its own Muslim population. I'm just wondering, to what extent, what type of pressure do you think the international community could apply to Syria? I think there's a very strong dislike against sanctions now because people feel that that only affects the average population and it doesn't hit the people you're trying to hit. And I know there's some talk of things like smart sanctions. Maybe you could talk about that or just give us some idea. What type of pressure could they apply that would be agreed to by the world community or at the UN?
Right. I think, you know, you're right in the sense that nobody wants economic sanctions on the Syrian people. And the experience of Iraq, 10 years of sanctions, what they did, they weakened the Iraqi society and they strengthened Saddam's hold on power. So nobody really is looking for that model. But I think there a lot can be done. And I think this is the direction maybe that both France, the U.S., maybe Britain now is joining on board. Diplomatic pressure, isolating the Syrian regime. And I think that's a good direction to go. Another thing is to go after the individuals who actually were implicated in the report, to go after their – a lot of them have money outside, so, you know, their assets should be frozen. They should be, you know, there should be kind of a warrant for their arrest, which would make their kind of, you know, any attempts for them to travel impossible. And so their loss can be done between, you know, imposing comprehensive sanctions and between doing nothing. And honestly, again, you know, one thing that's, you know, we've been kind of talking to, you know, the members of the administration in this country and telling them, I think we should tell the Syrian people we do care about democracy in Syria, because I think this is up to now, all we tell Syria is that we don't like their behavior regarding Iraq. We don't like their, you know, intervention in Lebanon, you know, regarding the Palestinian situation. But nobody at the highest level in the administration said, you know, maybe Syria needs democracy, like Lebanon, you know, did. And I think a lot of Syrians maybe would like the Lebanese model of change, in which after the assassination of Hariri, you know, hundreds of thousands of people took into the street with kind of international sympathy support. And I think that's kind of model I prefer to any type of change. I don't believe that, you know, democratic change could come from, you know, outside, but outside pressure, if it's really sincere and you know, done correctly, could support domestic democratic movements.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to underscore something that you were talking about in response to the caller, I do think it's really interesting, and perhaps this also makes it difficult to understand Syria's internal politics and how Syrian people feel about their government, because it seems that the Syrian people do indeed have very mixed feelings. That is, they were angry about the assassination of Hariri, but they were also angry about the way that Syria withdrew from Lebanon. Mm-hmm. They think the Melis report was politically motivated. They don't like the outside world thinking badly of Syria and leaning on it. On the other hand, they're in many ways they maybe are not happy with the government, think that it's incompetent, think that it's corrupt, think that it's a real mix of things, so that I'm sure that makes it difficult to answer a straightforward question like, well, what exactly do the people of Syria think about their government?
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is, and I think, you know, people do have these mixed feelings, and maybe Syrians could be divided. I mean, some of them are more concerned about, you know, external maybe intervention in their countries, and they look toward Iraq, and they don't want to repeat that model by, you know, any means. I mean, they feel, okay, many of them, while they definitely support change, but they want change from, you know, bad to neutral, maybe, if not good. But nobody wants, you know, change from bad to worse, you know. And that, I think that people feel that will happen in Iraq. So there's a serious kind of, you know, fear there. But on the other hand, I think, you know, and I've been in contact with many of the politically active individuals inside Syria. Well, many of them feel, you know, international pressure maybe is a good thing if, again, it is really applied properly. And I should mention here that there was, on October 16, various opposition groups inside Syria issued a petition was named the Damascus Declaration. And this declaration basically calls for a democratic change in Syria. It calls for the introduction of a new constitution that allows the formation of political parties and basically changes the regime from a one-party system into a multi-party system. It calls for more freedoms, lifting emergency laws, you know. And what was good about this document, in fact, it kind of was charted by the most important forces inside Syria, both political parties, which some of them are not recognized, and by individuals, some of them like Riyad Saif, who the parliamentarian who was imprisoned back in 2001 for criticizing corruption among the government. And then this document was endorsed by all of the opposition outside. So it became like the consensus of the Syrian, you know, opposition. And I mentioned my friend Kamal Labwani, who is an activist. Actually, he was here trying to seek support for this document from the international community, from both the EU and the U.S. So I think, you know, that's something encouraging, you know, for someone who really cares about democracy, human rights in Syria. So I believe, I think a lot of people would support, you know, the demand for political and economic reforms in the country.
I want to ask you about something else that has occurred within the last month. It was back in around the middle of October. The government of Syria announced that the country's interior minister, a man named Ghazi Kanan, had committed suicide. And this apparently led to all kinds of speculation about what had happened, why he had done it, whether he had somehow been forced into doing this. And the idea of the Syrians was that it would deflect some of the responsibility for the Hariri death. Some of what I have read suggests that what this was about was that Mr. Kanan was in a position to politically challenge Bashar al-Assad, and so it was a way of sweeping this man out of the way. This may be going too far into palace intrigue, but was this a significant event?
It was. for two reasons. Number one, Mr. Canaan was the head of the military Syrian forces in Lebanon for almost 20 years, between actually 82 and 2002. And so he was, you know, he knew the politics of Lebanon in and out. He had a major role in the events which took place during these two decades in Lebanon. And there were rumors that actually he was, you know, maybe someone in the security establishment who kind of objected to the idea of the assassination of Hariri. Some even suggested that he was actually interviewed by the Millis report, that maybe he talked too much in a way. The second reason, again, you know, this person is maybe the last one, the last security chief that was around, you know, Assad, the father. So he's really from that kind of generation. He was in his 60s. And as you kind of suggested, there were rumors that he might be someone to really challenge Bashar from within. So his, suicide or announced suicide was, was not kind of, you know, accepted by the Syrians. There were a lot of, you know, suspicion whether he really was suicide or homicide. But anyway, there is like something related to his suicide. Syria formed its own investigation committee kind of a couple of days ago, and they said, we are going to investigate the assassination of Hariri, and people were so, you know, skeptical about that. So there was a joke in the country which says that the Syrian investigation committee reached its conclusion and they found Hariri committed suicide. Basically they're referring to Canaan, who a lot of people believe he was killed, actually. He was murdered possibly by the president's brother-in-law, who was a rival of his.
Hmm. The Syrians had, in the wake of the Millis report and all of the allegations, the charges that somehow they were involved in the death of Hariri, have been reaching out, have been trying to organize support or looking for support from the rest of the Arab world.
Right.
And I gather that perhaps it has not been quite as strongly forthcoming as the Syrians would like. How does the rest of the world look? The rest of the Arab world, and I realize we're talking about a lot of different governments in a lot of different countries. But how is the rest of the Arab world thinking about Syria these days?
I think there are three maybe major Arab countries that could help Syria. These are Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and possibly Jordan. Saudi Arabia has been kind of ambivalent about this whole issue. For once, Hariri was very close to Saudi Arabia. In fact, he had a Saudi citizenship. He made his wealth in Saudi Arabia. And he was, known as, Saudi Arabia's man in Lebanon, in a way. So they were very upset about his assassination. And I think the more they're convinced that maybe Syria had something to do, they won't, be kind of forthcoming into helping Syria. For Egypt, I think Egypt is finds itself under pressure to try to do something, especially in the eyes of Arabs, that, since Egypt is the largest Arab country, they don't want to see the scenario in Iraq repeated in Syria. So basically their effort is to try to see, if they could mediate between the Syrian government and the international community. But a lot of what they say is, we encourage Syria to cooperate with the investigation. So nobody is going against the international, let's say, Security Council 1636, for instance. So it really trying to urge the Syrian leadership to evade, if possible, any further kind of isolation by the international community and possibly actions by the international community. Jordan, I think, would wait to see how the U.S. would act, and they follow suit. Syria maybe was expecting more from the Arab world, but the realities of the Arab world are such that, they shouldn't count much on it.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Najib Ghanban, he is Associate Professor of Political Science and Middle East Studies at the University of Arkansas and is interested in politics of the Arab world and in Syrian politics specifically, and that is what we're talking about here this morning in this hour of the show. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Is there within Syria a militant Islamist opposition of any significance, and is that in a position to pose a problem for the Syrian government?
This is a very good question, actually. There is a kind of an Islamic, you know, kind of trend in Syria, and this trend could be maybe measured by increased religiosity, you know, among many Syrians. You see, you know, more observance of, you know, women wearing scarves in the last maybe few years. That's one general kind of trend, which we don't know how it might be translated politically. But there is historically one political group known as the Muslim Brotherhood, who in fact came into a confrontation with the Syrian regime back in the 80s. Confrontation, you might remember, ended with a major confrontation in the city of Hama, in which thousands of people were killed when the security forces basically destroyed the old part of the city and defeated the Brotherhood. But it was at a high human, you know, kind of cost. The human rights report said, you know, up to maybe 20,000 people were killed. But since the 1990s, the movement was mostly active in the outside. Lately, I think the movement really reformed its discourse and came close to other opposition figures inside and outside Syria, and it became more of a mainstream. It did join the Damascus Declaration, for instance, and endorsed it. So they're very much like a moderate Islamic group. And then there are other, you know, religious groups around certain figures throughout the country. Very, very, like, lately, there have been some reports about militant, you know, actually small groups, some of which have been involved in encouraging people to go and fight in Iraq. And even the Syrian government announced that over the last few months they had confrontation with some of these individuals. But, you know, there's a wide kind of widespread belief that the government itself, in fact, is in kind of helping some of these groups, and some of them come from outside Syria, to go and fight in Iraq. The idea here is that, you know, more trouble for the American in Iraq, less pressure on Syria. But we really don't know the extent of that, because I think the U.S. really exaggerates the support Syria lends to the insurgency in Iraq. And I do believe Syria, you know, had done something to reduce that. But it's still going on. I mean, there are evidence, you know, reading neutral reports, I think, which shows that there are still people who are crossing the border from Syria to Iraq.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood, because one of the stories that I came across in trying to read up on Syria was a story about the Muslim Brotherhood and whether or not the Muslim Brotherhood had actually tried to open up a channel of communications to the United States. And apparently the headline of the story is, well, the Muslim Brotherhood says no. No, we weren't doing that. We're not interested in trying to do that. However, the fact that such a story would circulate, and, you know, the fact that indeed in the past the United States has in a not very subtle and sophisticated way tried to involve itself in the internal politics of other countries if it identified some particular group of people that somehow it thought it could use, or were sympathetic, or were opponents of the regime. And sometimes I think that reflected a very incomplete understanding of the politics of that place. I guess that raises the question of the United States. Is it in some sort of subtle ways trying to establish any kind of connection between groups, political groups within Syria that might be opponents of the current regime, and doing that as a way of accomplishing a kind of regime change?
I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I hear of you know, efforts from both, actually, the government, U.S. government, and opposition in Syria to maybe at least talk, or, you know, see if they could reach some kind of an understanding. But Regarding the Brotherhood, it's actually my understanding in this country that the administration has not decided to endorse the Muslim Brotherhood in various, actually, countries in the Arab world. They still prefer to deal with individuals. I mean, there's one figure, Syrian figure, actually, a Syrian-American, who is the favorite, maybe, opposition group to the U.S. His name is Farid al-Ghadri. He has a group called the Reform Party. And he doesn't really have much following in Syria. But I think lately the administration maybe was trying to reach out to other opposition figures. I mentioned my friend Kamal Labwani, who was in the U.S., and he did meet with some officials at the State Department and maybe other agencies. But I mean, I know what took place in those meetings because I met him afterward. And really, basically, the U.S. was trying to see who are the political groups, who are, what their views and so on and so forth. And he was trying to get support for Damascus Declaration specifically. And it wasn't easy to do that. For many of us, in fact, who care about democracy, I mean, I've been critical of the U.S. government for not, forcefully advocating democratic change in Syria. I mean, the Congress passed something called the Syrian Accountability Act. And requiring Syria to cooperate on many foreign policy questions. And that's fine, including Lebanon. This is prior to the withdrawal of Syrians from Lebanon. But they never mention human rights and democracy and the rights of the Syrian people to, change their government. And I've been critical of that. So I think now maybe there are some signs that the administration is looking into that, especially if they see that Bashar maybe might, his position might be jeopardized by the aftermath of the investigation, the Hariri investigation.
Syria has a very long border with Iraq, and there has been criticism by the United States of Syria for allowing or perhaps not doing enough to stop insurgents going over the border, going from Syria into Iraq. What sort of interest does Syria have in Iraq, and what sort of Iraq do you think the Syrians would like to see?
Well, prior to the collapse of Saddam's government, there was a major improvement in relations between Syria and Iraq, historically, Syria and Iraq had a troubling relationship, although both were ruled by the Ba'ath Party, but they were always, competing. There were personal differences between Saddam and Assad, the father. They really had terrible relations. But over the last 2 or 3 years, both countries saw economic interest as the really key issue. So Iraq tried to use Syria as a window to maybe relax the international sanctions imposed on it. And in return, Syria was given oil from Iraq at reduced price. So relations the last 2 years before Saddam's collapse were actually improving. Now, when the U.S. decided to go to war against Iraq, Syria opposed that war, like many countries did in the international community, so it was not really unique to it. They felt that American presence, military presence on their border could be threatening not only to the regime but to the country, so they opposed it. Right after, I think, the fall down of Saddam regime and the beginning of the so-called insurgency, I think, Syria was supporting some elements in the insurgency. And again, the key interest was they don't want the U.S. military presence to, last for a long time there. I mean, there were plans that the U.S. were going to build, long-term military bases and so on and so forth. And I think that put the Syrian government in kind of confrontation with the U.S. So all of these reports we hear about Syria continue to, support the insurgency. I think they have some, truth to them, but maybe they're exaggerated. But the real confrontation came with the international community over Lebanon. And then, so Iraq could be used all the times as a second kind of, front in terms of the conflicting interest between the U.S. and Syria.
What does it? Would it matter to the Syrians very much now in Iraq? The big question is, what sort of country is it likely to be, and is it possible for it to be a unified country with a sense of, with Iraqi people having a sense of they are Iraqis, or is it going to be a country that seems likely to fracture along ethnic and religious lines? Would it matter to the Syrians very much which of those two directions Iraq went in?
Definitely. And I don't know if you mean here by the Syrians, the Syrian government or Syrian people or Syria in general. I think the idea that, many of the Arab world would not like to see countries which in fact were created by the colonial powers back, after World War I and World War II, are further disintegrated into smaller entities. I mean, that's a general kind of, tendency. They would like to see more political integration and forming of blocs, like that's what's going to strengthen these countries. So as a general kind of interest. There's always fear. I mean, most countries, Syria itself could face, in fact, sectarian tensions. I mean, while Syria is different, from Iraq, there's three major communities, the Shiite Arabs, the Sunni Arabs, and the Kurds. In Syria, there is a clear majority, that is the Sunni Arabs. They make up about 76%. But then there is the Alawite community. It's a kind of an extreme sect of Shiite Islam, which basically Assad comes, from that sect, and they have overrepresentation in government. And so, there is a fear that any sectarian conflict might spill over. In fact, one reason why Syria went to Lebanon to prevent from, that civil war from kind of reaching Syria in a way. So I think as a general interest, nobody likes to see division in Iraq. Nobody likes to see continued civil war in Iraq. And that could be true of both the government and the people of Syria. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did very well. And certainly I take your point of drawing the distinction between what the government would think, what the people of Syria would think. So,
right.
In any case, we're going to have to stop because I think we've come to the end of the time. Our guest this morning, Dr. Najib Ghadban. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and Middle East Studies at the University of Arkansas and is very interested in and has been following the politics of Syria for a long time. Professor Ghadban, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Programming here on WILL is made possible by a grant from Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Today's programming is also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor. And that is that for us here on Focus 580. Just a reminder that tomorrow morning we'll be talking about some of the proposals to change the federal tax code that are now going around in Washington, D.C. Our guest for the show will be Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. Also, we'll be talking about some of the research that's gone on over the last few years about twins. And our guest will be Nancy Siegel. She's director of the Twins Study Center at the California State University Fullerton and has authored a book entitled Indivisible by Two, Lives of Extraordinary Twins. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We welcome your questions. Right now, we hope you'll stay tuned. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine. The host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about filmmaker Alan Pakula. We will talk about his life and his films with Jared Brown, who has written a biography of Pakula, Alan J. Pakula, His Life and His Films. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. December wheat is trading at 312 and a quarter, down 2 3/4. March, 328 and a half, down 2 3/4. December corn, 194 and a half, down 3/4. March, 208 and a half, down 1. May corn, 216 and a half, down 1 1/4.